Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Black History Month comes to a close this week, we're closing the show each day with contributors to the New York Times 1619 Project. 1619 as in the year enslaved Africans first arrived in what became the United States. Joining me now is Jasmine Hughes, a story editor for the New York Times Magazine, who edited and co-wrote a history of slavery for the 1619 special section in the Times print edition. Jasmine, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Happy Black History Month.
And to you. And we've been talking to reporters all week, as you know, about the project. But let's talk about the moment when it all started, 1619 itself, in Port Comfort, Virginia, a terribly inaptly named place for this, the first time enslaved Africans were brought to the United States. How did that happen?
I know. Port Comfort, I think, is what people would call ironic. So in earlier in the year 1619, there was a Portuguese slave ship that was actually on its way to Mexico. It was filled with captive Africans from what is now Angola, but what was called then the kingdoms of Ndongo and Congo. While they were on their voyage, they were seized by two English pirate ships, and then the captured enslaved Africans were taken to Port Comfort, which later became the Virginian territory close to Jamestown. And we know about this because there's a letter from the colonist John Ralph, who said that a Dutch man of war arrived to the colony and brought, quote, not anything but 20 and odd Negroes, which the governor and Cape merchant bought for victuals or provisions.
Was racialized forced labor considered normal at that time?
No, not yet. So forced labor wasn't uncommon at this point because Africans and Europeans have been trading goods and people across the Mediterranean for centuries. But none of this was based on race. But once the transatlantic slave trade was introduced, it began as early as the 15th century. That's when, you know, we started to see a system of slavery that was commercialized and racialized, as well as inherited from generation to generation.
Can you talk about the Catholic Church's role in the slave trade's origin in the 15th century? I know you wrote about that.
Yes. So it surprised me to find out that the Catholic Church actually endorsed slavery. They granted Portugal a monopoly on trade in West Africa and in Spain to colonize the New World and to spread the good word about Catholicism. So Mary Elliott, who I worked on this project with, who is a curator at the African American History Museum, mm-hmm. And I wrote about how Pope Nicholas V actually buoyed Portuguese efforts and issued a piece of legislation that affirmed Portugal's exclusive rights to territories it claimed around that West African coast. So all of this was done with the endorsement of the church in order to spread Catholicism.
And I'm reading from your material that Pope Nicholas V buoyed Portuguese efforts and issued the Romanus Pontifex of 1455, which affirmed Portugal's exclusive rights to territories it claimed along the West African coast and the trade from those areas. And yet that doesn't explicitly mention trade in human beings.
However, that piece of legislation granted the right to invade and plunder and, quote, reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Again, they wanted to spread the good word of Catholicism, and I have here that the state of Spain issued a contract that authorized the direct shipment of captive Africans mm-hmm. for trade in the Spanish colonies.
And so it began with permission for Portugal and Spain to control the slave trade, as you've been describing, quickly spread to England, the Netherlands, France, Denmark. And your project at the time, 1619, has been a reckoning with how integral enslaved people were to the founding of this country and the institution of slavery. Why do you think the countries in Europe haven't really had something like this, or do you think they have?
You know, I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer that question, but, you know, just from my personal opinion, I think that the African-American population in the United States actually obviously outweighs those in European countries, and I think that... Because we have such a an education about slavery in elementary school and middle school, that we sort of learn about it in this really sanitized way. And obviously the point of the 1619 Project was to have a more realistic exploration of what slavery was actually like. But because it's embedded into our school system, but in such a weird way, I think that we think about it and we talk about it, but we're not talking about it or thinking about it or dealing with it realistically. And that is the root of the problem.
Now, Africa at the time that we've been talking about was ruled by monarchies who fought fiercely against the Portuguese. Let's kind of rescue a name from the dustbin of history. Can you tell our listeners about Queen Nzinga?
Yes. So this is Queen Nzinga, who was a ruler in what we call present-day Angola. And as the Portuguese were trying to colonize her territory and capture her people, she fought against them to maintain the safety of her territory. She died in 1663, but by that point, she had actually made peace with the Portuguese, and her state began trading with them on equal footing. But she was one of the first, if not the first or only female ruler in that territory during that time, and she was known for being an incredibly powerful warrior and really shrewd ruler.
This week we talked earlier about Thomas Jefferson's misguided ideas that helped to uphold slavery, but we haven't talked about how people were actively trying to stop him. So going from resistance in Africa to resistance in this country, and one example is Benjamin Banneker, a free black mathematician and scientist who wrote to Jefferson, who was then the Secretary of State. You're familiar with what was in that letter, right?
Yes. So Benjamin Banneker was, as you said, like a highly achieved person. And so he wrote, and a black man. And so he wrote this letter to Thomas Jefferson, basically encouraging him to re-examine his prejudices against people of African descent. And Thomas Jefferson was essentially like, you're the exception to the rule. Like, you're incredibly talented. But he wasn't sure that there were many other black people who could match Banneker's intellect. Jefferson openly speculated that black people were inferior to white people and actually advocated for the removal from U.S. territory at the time. And so Banneker really was trying to show Jefferson that people of African descent were of equal intellect and of equal, who deserved the same rights as he did. But, Jefferson kind of wasn't buying it.
We're going to run out of time in a minute, and your phone is starting to break up anyway, but many of the writers for this project are a generation older than you are, I think it's fair to say. Do you think there was a generational difference in your understandings about slavery with so many contributors?
I don't think so. So I'm 28, and in talking to, and I'm a black American, and in speaking to my parents who are in their early 50s, who were able to experience like television programs such as Roots, I think that there was a lot more focus for them. And then, again, because there wasn't like a huge cultural moment around slavery when I was in elementary school, we sort of just glided over it.
And we leave it there with Jasmine Hughes, story editor for the New York Times Magazine, who edited and co-wrote A History of Slavery for the 1619 Broadsheet special section. You can find the article online titled A Brief History of Slavery That You Didn't Learn in School. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And we will wrap up this Black History Month series tomorrow with Ann Bailey, professor of history at SUNY Binghamton, on the sites where enslaved people were sold from East Brunswick, New Jersey to Monticello.